Welcome to my show. This is Dr. David Kent. This is my weekly show. It comes on every Sunday morning at 9 in the morning or so. Appreciate you tuning in. If this is your first time, I'm a psychiatrist in Boise. I've been practicing here since 1990. If you're not tuning in for the first time, welcome back. I appreciate you staying tuned with me. I try to bring on interesting topics every week, bring in different speakers and guests, experts in their field. I almost always have a patient come in who talks about their experience and what has not worked and what does work for them. So I appreciate you tuning in. I talk a lot about various mental illnesses, but I focus a lot on depression, partly because depression is so common. It's the most common mental illness that we treat. Also affects all walks of life. Anybody can be affected by it. I also like to bring on new information, anything that might be cutting edge. I've talked in the past quite a bit about a concept called neuroplasticity, and that's where the brain has the capacity to actually grow. We used to think of the brain as something that sort of deteriorates over time, and there's some truth to some of that, but also the brain can still learn and grow, and that growth is called neuroplasticity. What does that mean exactly? Well, the brain is made up of trillions of neurons in various parts of the brain. They have different circuits, different functions. Some parts of the brain are what we call older parts of the brain from an evolutionary standpoint. That means that many different creatures or animals have those same parts. Those lower parts of the brain are a little bit older. In one part of the brain, there was a study in Queensland, I believe New Zealand, that talked about the amygdala. And the amygdala is a small little part of the brain, deep in the brain, kind of deep down. That part of the brain is associated with fear and anxiety, sort of the fight or flight mechanism. Well, they recently showed that the amygdala is capable of neuroplasticity, meaning that it can create new connections. And that's important from a treatment standpoint, and that might be able to help people who have fear problems, people who have PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder, even people with depression and anxiety. So we'll stay tuned on that front, but everything I see points to the brain being changeable. And I've talked about that quite a bit. I've had Dr. Mark George on my show. He comes on an earlier segment. He's the world expert on TMS, or transcranial magnetic stimulation, and all forms of brain stimulation. So he talks a lot about neuroplasticity and what changes are being made with the brain by treating it in effective ways. My show has lots of different people on. I've had Dr. Novak on. He's a local area expert on political information and political concepts and governmental issues. Last week, I had Dr. Negron, Roberto Negron, on my show. He talked a lot about suicide risk factors and statistics, things like that, and what people can do to get help and treatment. Today, I have on my show, again, Liza Long. She's was famous for a blog she wrote in 2012, which was "I Am Adam Lanza's Mom," and that's famous because Adam Lanza was the individual who ended up doing the Sandy Hook Elementary School, where he ended up killing multiple children and administrators and teachers and himself and his mother. So that was a very traumatic, terrible incident that happened. Liza Long wrote a blog about that, and that went viral. She's coming on my next segment. She's going to be on today talking about the school system and school issues, how to advocate for your child, what the issues are, and what you can do about it to make schools more part of the solution rather than part of the problem. In the school system, about 20% of children have a serious mental illness by the time they're 18 years of age. So it's not a small problem. It's actually a large problem. So I want you to stay tuned for that segment. Also, you can go to my website at treasurevalleytms.com. On there, I have a lot of information about mental illness, depression. I write my own blog. I have my weekly radio show. I post all of these programs on my show. So every week, you can listen into my show if you missed the show. Last week, I was on KTVB or Channel 7 on Thursday. I did a segment on there. I had a patient come on and talk about her experience with TMS and her success with treatment. So I'm going to post that on my website as well. You can follow me on Facebook at Treasure Valley TMS. I'm posting almost every day. Lots of new information, new things coming out. So stay tuned, And I appreciate you listening in. So come on to my next segment. This is Dr. David Kent.
Welcome back to my show. This is Dr.
David Kent. I'm a local area psychiatrist. If you're tuning in for the first time, it's my weekly show. I invite different guests on my show almost every week. Today I've got a repeat guest, Eliza Long. She was on the show last month, I believe, or about a month or so ago. She's gotten herself quite famous for a variety of reasons. She's a noted author. She is the president of the local chapter of NAMI, which stands for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. But she really got famous initially when she sort of wrote a blog, which she didn't feel would go very far. But the topic was, I guess, pretty timely. The topic was, I am Adam Lanza's mom. That immediately went viral within 24 hours, and then she got national exposure, was on a bunch of national shows, and that's kind of how it got started. Subsequently, she wrote a book, The Price of Silence, which I read from page to page all the way through. I couldn't really lay it down. It was a really good book. And I'm a psychiatrist, so I can be pretty critical of stuff written about mental illness and mental health and mental disorders. And I can tell you, Eliza did her homework on that book. She really put in time. I don't know how she pulled it off, but it's a really good book. If you have any interest in mental illness or mental disorders, or you have family members that have a mental disorder, that's a great book to read because it talks about her own experience, but it also quotes really credible sources. So welcome back to my show, Eliza.
Thank you so much for having me back and for your kind words about the book and my advocacy work.
You are a really good voice, and I appreciate that as a psychiatrist.
Well, thank you.
It's good to have someone at the grassroots trying to make a difference.
Well, I think that as parents, no one's ever going to love our kids quite like we do, and so we have to learn to fight for them.
And that's what you find in NAMI, right? A lot of the parents are fighting for their kids.
We've got parents, but we've also got peers. One of the best parts for me personally of working with NAMI has been getting to meet people and know people who are living in recovery with their mental illness and to see the very brave things that they do every single day out in the community, since there is still so much stigma that attaches to mental illness.
I'm sure it's very educational for you to be in that role.
You've been
the mother role for a long time. Saw it firsthand and struggle with it and struggle with your son and what to do with him and how to get him help. And, you know, sort of fortuitously, wasn't really intended through your blog and becoming nationally noticed, basically, an expert stepped forward and got the appropriate treatment for your son.
Yes, and that was the true gift of speaking up in our case, was that Eric was finally appropriately diagnosed and treated. I think that's a message that you try to promote, Dr. Kent, that you know, treatment works, recovery is possible, and many people can have the outcomes that my family experienced.
But it didn't seem that way, I'm sure, for the longest time, because you struggled with the school system, which we're going to talk about today, the legal system, other people, and what their view of you was as a parent. Things like that. It was all a big struggle until sort of you got the right treatment. And Eric came on the show, your son, and it was amazing. He was very articulate. He's very intelligent. He went from kind of being the bullied kid to being kind of the famous kid. And it's not all bad, but it was interesting to hear him talk. And he has goals he wants to pursue. He's a novelist and writing all kinds of books. So it's pretty impressive to see your son.
Thank you. He's also become a really good self-advocate, and he works with Youth Move here in Idaho. That's a great organization for teens, young people who want to get involved and make a difference in our community with mental illness.
I'm sure he's a great voice for it because he's articulate, he's intelligent. For 17 years old, I was really blown away.
I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah,
I'm
you
his
should
mom.
Be. Yeah, yeah, well, it doesn't fall far from the tree, though. That's the thing. So let's talk a little bit about the topic of the day. We want to talk about the education system, and I'll just let you start out and kind of talk about it from the perspective of kids who have mental illness who go through the system, and maybe what you have to say about that.
Well, I think if we look at the statistics, if we start there, the National Institute of Mental Health says that 1 in 5 children will experience a serious and debilitating mental disorder at some point before the age of 18. So that number, to put that in context, if you've got a class of kindergartners, sweet little kindergartners, 1 in 5 of those children at some point in their education is going to experience something that may disrupt the learning environment for that child, but also that child's learning experience. And that was certainly true in my case. to make it more personal, we first really had to confront Eric's mental illness when he was a kindergartner because his disruptive behaviors were so disruptive that they had to clear the room order in place for the classroom. And I think that so many people don't quite understand the impact that this has, not just on our children like mine who are living with mental illness, but on the entire learning environment, on the entire school system. And for me, that's become a real area of concern because I think that the schools could really be part of the solution that families like mine are looking for. But it takes us kind of thinking about things a little differently than we do right now.
I've looked at there's lots of different angles to this, and I can understand sometimes the school's view. We've become so legalistic in our society. I think there's a sense of protectionism to protect the legal environment and protect themselves. But sometimes that's at the sake of our children.
Well, sure. I think, unfortunately, and I don't think intentionally, the school system has become somewhat adversarial for parents like me. And I say unintentionally because the individual administrators and teachers I've worked with through my long journey, and I myself am an educator at college, I know that we're all really well-intentioned. We are all in that field, surprisingly, not to make money, but because we are passionate about education, because we love children and we want to help them. And every teacher, every administrator that we encountered on our journey, almost without exception, with maybe one or two exceptions, was really committed to Eric's progress and making sure that he did as well as possible. That being said, you know, the question of how to handle a child who has disruptive behaviors in the classroom is definitely one that impacts all of us, right? Like if my son's behavior is disruptive, and I think Eric would be the first to say his, we're not talking about somebody who just won't do work. We're talking about a child who might call fire and death down on his class from the skies. So very disruptive behaviors in the classroom. Certainly we have to recognize that. Becomes a real challenge for parents because we just don't know what to do. We're battling insurance companies. We're battling, you know, the stigma, people saying it's our bad parenting. We can't find support in our communities. We get into the school system, and this is a problem that affects everybody, not just our child, but other children. And so we have to become educated very quickly in, like you said, laws that, you know, none of us went to law school. We don't know what this is, what our children's rights are, what we can reasonably expect for our children in the classroom. And I still remember feeling completely overwhelmed during those first meetings where we would sit down and people would say, okay, we have to come up with a plan that's going to help your son and also help all the other children. And they throw out letters at you, IEP, SED. You know, do you know what those letters are? I didn't know. ADA, 504. I've gotten really educated. So parents, as they move on this journey, may very well find themselves at an IEP meeting. That's an individualized education plan meeting. And that's where the school's going to sit down with you and try to come up with a plan. I think that one of the challenges for me was that other parents obviously were resistant to my child's negative behaviors in the classroom. Obviously, I would feel the same way about my own children. But at the same time, there was very little willingness to move the blame either away from me or away from my child and to instead recognize that Eric deserved a free and appropriate public education just like their children did. And that our current system, with its well-intentioned but harmful zero-tolerance policies, for example, is particularly hard, even devastating to children like my son. We were in something called the school to prison pipeline with Eric. And if you've never heard that phrase before, it should chill you. And I think those well-meaning parents who want to protect their children and who think that a child like my child is a bad kid need to understand these aren't bad kids. These are behavioral symptoms of a brain difference. And the consequences to taxpayers, to society, of deciding that these children deserve to go straight from school and into the prison system, it's truly overwhelming and devastating. And it starts in second grade. We start with labels in second grade that are going to affect how a child is able to interact as an adult in the future.
That's a good point. One thing that not only in the school system, but in general as a society, putting our heads in the sand doesn't make these things go away. No. And I think there's a tendency to want to do that in the school system where you just don't want to face this or we don't really acknowledge it. And somehow it might just go away, but it only gets worse by doing that.
Well, I think, you know, we have a very, for lack of a better word, a somewhat inflexible school system right now, where we also maybe make expectations on even young children that I wonder how realistic some of the expectations are even for neurotypical children. For example, that classroom of second graders, is it realistic to expect them to sit there at desks by themselves and pay attention for 45 minutes without moving, without interacting, without hands-on learning? Is that really a realistic expectation? And of course, I know as well as you do that the good teachers out there are not instructing in this way, right?
Right.
They're not making their children sit there rigidly, but it does take some creativity, it takes some flexibility. And from the teacher's standpoint, I'm very sympathetic, again, because I am an educator. Teachers aren't trained either. Just like parents are trying to get up to speed on all this, teachers are not mental health professionals. They did not go to school and get a degree in psychiatry. They don't, or psychology. A lot of this is new to them. They don't completely understand what they're facing. I remember talking to my mother, who's a first grade teacher. We have our weekly debriefs on the children in her classroom and trying to come up with creative solutions for these kids because she's so committed to their success. But she said that to me once. She goes, you know, I didn't learn any of this in school. I learned how to teach. I didn't learn how to manage behaviors like this, like these behaviors I'm seeing. But I've come to see the schools as potentially a source, a huge resource for our communities. If you think about it, the school is the one place where the child goes every day, right? And with just a few tweaks in our system, like what if we, for example, created a school resource room that had a swing for children who needed to self-regulate, right? That had sensory activities for children, that was a place that children could go during the day and feel safe. Rather than removing them out of the schools, which is what we do right here in Boise right now, children on serious emotional disturbance, IEPs, 50% of them drop out of high school. I mean, this is a huge, huge issue. And here in our community, I was shocked to learn that we actually segregate these children in extreme cases like Eric's. We pull them out of mainstream schools. We put them into a school where they can't even actually earn a high school diploma. That might surprise some of your listeners, especially if that hasn't been part of their path.
We'll talk some more about that. I'm going to go ahead and stop right here. We're going to come back in just a minute. We'll have a commercial break. I've got Liza Long on the line on my show. I've got Liza Long on my show today. Really happy to have her on the show. She's very articulate, very educated and knowledgeable. She became famous for a blog she wrote a few years back. She's written the book, The Price of Silence, which is a great book. We're talking about the school system here in the Treasure Valley, especially the Boise School District and a little in the Meridian School District, and sort of her experience and sort of her knowledge and some statistics as well. Mental illness really is a common problem, and it's not just a few isolated families who have that problem. It's maybe 20% of kids by the time they're 18 will have a serious mental illness. So it is a real problem. So we're talking about that, talking about her experience. Let me just express real quickly, I've got a son, well, two sons, but one mainly who has a mental illness, and he had a lot of trouble in school. And when he was in eighth grade, he had to stop going to school for a few months because he was so depressed he couldn't get out of bed, really couldn't perform, he wasn't liked the way he treated at school, so he just didn't want to go. So we had to find, you know, an alternative situation for him the next year. Fortunately, it worked out okay. But one of the things you mentioned is the IOP and or IEP, IEP, excuse me, and there's other different programs. And I know that we, in that system, we really had to get our own education about it because the schools weren't really forthcoming about what our options were. It felt like they didn't really want to necessarily go there.
Well, I think, again, taking the school side, you can understand where they're coming from. This whole idea, I don't want to throw out a lot of acronyms, but the IEP, the Individualized Education Plan, came from the very positive idea that I think we'd all agree with, that every child deserves a free and appropriate public education. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an administrator who did not agree with that. However, one of the challenges is this was a federal mandate for all states, but it was an unfunded mandate. So anyone who works in government immediately realizes, oh, you mean we may have to provide special supports for kids so they can succeed in the classroom, and that's going to cost us, and then we're not going to have enough money to help to do the other stuff that we have to do. And so I definitely get the school side that, and I get other parents' side. I've heard this from other parents where they're like, well, it's not fair. Your kid gets all these resources, and what about my kid? You know, I get it. The what about my kid? Sure. At the same time, I think we need to return to that positive that every child deserves a free and appropriate public education, right? And then we need to be a lot more creative about how we approach solutions for that. Certainly, getting funding would be a great first step, but sometimes in our current environment, that can be a challenge. does seem to be a truly bipartisan issue if you think about it, though. Pretty much people on the right and the left support education, right? And if we started seeing education and these IEP meetings not as adversarial, which they very much are right now, whether, you know, again, I don't blame administrators, I don't blame parents, but I think any parent who has heard the word IEP and had to deal with that is a little triggered, right? Like, you immediately go to that place where you're gearing up for battle and you're going to go in and fight for your child. One book I have to recommend, she's right here in the Treasure Valley, Charmaine Thayer is an amazing advocate for kids with special needs and for their families. And I think finding an advocate like Charmaine who is educated about all this stuff and knows how to fight those battles, that is really a good strategy for parents. Know that you don't have to go it alone, because you really aren't an expert in all of this stuff. And you're right, the school district doesn't have to tell you everything, right? So having an advocate like Charmaine, her book is called The Art of Advocacy. I think the subtitle is something like How to Get Through an IEP Meeting Collaboratively, something like that. I think as we view it more as a collaborative process where we're all centered around helping not only my child, but all the children in the classroom, seeing that as a collaborative exercise, that's the way to go. And again, before the break, I talked, I really think schools could be a huge part of the solution for our kids, for kids with mental illness, right? If we just kind of rethought what that school day looked like for the child.
I agree with you. One thing is, you know, we talk about this fairness thing. It's not fair, your child, my child, this and that. We have to look at us, kind of step out of the trees a minute, get out and look at the forest. By an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So when we identify children who have difficulties early on and get them early treatment and early intervention, we can prevent a whole host of cost to society.
Correct.
For your son in particular, if he hadn't gotten this national expert, hadn't gotten the right treatment, we could still be talking about all the problems he's having in school and behaviors and being kicked out. Maybe he's in the legal system again. Maybe he's got a long term. Maybe he gets a felony.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, that's a huge cost to society. So we want, it helps society to treat people early and accurately.
Right.
If we do that, it helps everyone.
It helps all of us. And you know, not just the individuals, but that cost, if anyone's doubting it, this has actually been measured, right? So like Judge Lifeman down in Miami-Dade County looked at the cost of just 90 individuals for accessing services and found that he could save $10 million a year. I mean, these are extraordinary costs. And, you know, if we just approach it from the cost standpoint, that's fine. I would encourage people to think about it from the moral standpoint, though, right? Like, no one holds a newborn baby in their arms and says, oh, I hope that you grow up to a lifetime of pain, right? That's not what any parent wants for his or her child. And so if we can go back to that moment to focus on what's going to be necessary for that child's success, that becomes a much more positive way to approach this issue rather than, you know, like you kind of alluded to it, the blame game that can sometimes go on, both with people who feel like their children are being cheated, administrators who are really working with far too small of budgets. It just doesn't have to be this way. It could be a positive solution for all of our kids.
Another way to look at it, too, is the school is like, because the kids spend so much time in school in their life, when you look at the amount of time they spend there, school should be a safety net. Mm-hmm. It should be catching these children, identifying there's a problem, encouraging an evaluation and treatment, and trying to get the child help so that they can succeed in school, which would mean that they might succeed in society. If they succeed in society, then they're a contributor rather than someone who's a drain on society.
Precisely. I think that's exactly the point I try to make. And, you know, another challenge if we look at what parents are facing, for example, I'm speaking to my own experience here, but I've heard from other families similar experiences. In my experience, because my child was so disruptive in the classroom, I was strongly encouraged to pursue the free virtual academy option for educating Eric. And, you know, that is a program that may work for many, many families, but to kind of put into perspective the whole family issue that mental illness becomes, because it is a whole family illness, I was a single mother. I was dependent on my employment for the health insurance I needed to provide care for my son. And I could not have left my child at home alone to do that classwork. I mean, he was a very sick child, right? So for this solution to be, well, what, you want me to quit my job? You want me to lose my health insurance? You want me to go on public assistance just so I can get care for my kid? These are the very real questions that many families are facing. I mean, I've said this many times. I was one of the luckiest people I know, and that I had an extremely flexible and supportive employer while I was going through this. I don't know many people who would have been able to juggle all of the appointments, all of the emergency calls to run into school, juvenile detention, court hearings, all of those things that I juggled and still managed to hold down a full-time job. That's not necessarily a credit to me. It's a credit to my employer. So again, as you're thinking about these costs to society, it takes everybody kind of getting on board and realizing that, you know, these aren't bad kids. These aren't bad parents. This is an illness, maybe like cancer. Maybe we should bring people a casserole. Maybe we should, you know, throw some preventative, as you say, resources at this problem rather than waiting for the very costly measures that we have to take if we don't manage this problem proactively.
That's a very good point. Your son himself even admits that, you know, he realized and understood that his behavior was a negative in his life. He didn't cast himself necessarily as the victim, but more as, I know there's something wrong with me. I know that I have behaviors, and I know I have buttons that can be pushed. I don't like it either.
Right.
A lot of these kids, they don't want this. They're not asking for this. They're not asking. They don't have handouts. They want to just get help.
Right.
And the more society can recognize that there's different sort of safety nets. There's the school system should be a safety net. Mm-hmm. The legal system should be a better safety net where we get people into treatment rather than to incarcerate them. We should get them into treatment. The ERs, physicians' offices, counselors' offices, everything represents a big safety net.
Right. And we really see just how fragmented our system of care and our so-called safety net is in this country when we look at the population that you and I are talking about, people living with serious mental illness. We see just how fragmented and how really costly and absurd that system of non-care in many cases is for families. Again, that is why I'm so passionate about education. I've never met a kid who didn't want to succeed in school. And I, you know, again, my mom's taught first grade for years. I've been in her classroom. I've been a college educator for years. I've never had a student who's been there sitting in my classroom and hasn't wanted to succeed. So if we can think creatively about what do we need to do for the environment, what can we change environmentally for this child? Again, back to the second grade classroom, the idea of a regulation room, something as simple as that could really make a huge difference in a child like mine's behavior in school, right? These kids want to self-regulate. You give them a mechanism to self-regulate. I mean, I'm not going to go to fidget spinners. Not going to go there. But, you know, the fidget spinner idea, one thing that was effective for Eric was having a squeezy ball, right? Yeah. Something as simple as a squeezy ball in the classroom. He had a third grade teacher who was like, oh, let's give you a squeezy ball. He had a sixth grade teacher who recognized that he had some trauma in his past and used trauma-informed education to tweak assignments. Not so that Eric wouldn't have to do the same level of work, but so that his assignment would recognize the trauma that Eric had been through and help him to do the same quality of assignment without having to relive that trauma. It's educators like that who are really making a difference. And I don't think we all have to reinvent the wheel, but it'd sure be great if we started recognizing those educators who are doing brave, amazing things in their classrooms.
There's definitely that. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We always have lots to talk about. You have lots to say, and I really like having you on my show. So I'd love to have you come back again in the future if you're agreeable. I'm going to keep tapping into you a little bit because you have such a good knowledge base. This is Liza Long on my show today. On my next segment, I've got another guest coming on my show to talk about her experience with depression.
Welcome back to my show. This is Dr. David Kent.
This is my weekly show I have on every Sunday. I'm excited on this last segment today. I've got a special guest on my show. Her name is Debbie. She's agreed to come on my show. She's one of my patients currently. Welcome to the show, Debbie.
Hi, thank you.
We'll start out a little bit to get to know you a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? How old are you, Debbie?
I am 63 years old, and I am retired, and I have a husband of 41 years. I've got two children grown, of course, and three grandsons.
Well, that's awesome. Marriages are tough to last very long at all, but that's a really solid, long marriage you've got going on.
Yeah, he's great.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
That's awesome. So I want to talk to you a little bit about depression. You suffer from depression, so tell the people listening out there, how long have you been struggling with depression?
Oh, gosh, pretty much, I would say about 37 years.
37 years.
Pretty much, yes. It seemed to have started when I had my first child and started with postpartum depression. And from then on, it just never left. And it came in different forms of depression. And I've been seeing doctors and having medications ever since.
Let's just start for a minute kind of understanding your depression. You said it's kind of been in many forms.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things have you experienced when you get depressed?
Oh, get depressed. I get a very heavy feeling. I'm feeling so down. I've lost interest in the things I used to love to do, and even going out with my friends, even keeping up the house, keeping up myself, and just doing a lot of sleeping and being in the dark.
That must be pretty miserable.
Oh, it's so miserable. It was so miserable.
It was. I like the past tense part of that part. A little bit about, we understand the sort of the symptoms of your depression and what that was like for you, but how did that affect your everyday life?
Oh, just, it was a chore just trying to get up. And of course, I had a child and I had to, of course, get up and meet his needs and all. And when he would take a nap, of course, I'd get down there and take a nap. I never made plans with other friends who had children. And so it was, I just felt I wasn't there for my son and for my husband. And then since then, we had adopted a daughter, and she's grown now, like I say. And just keeping up with her as and then having another child, trying to get them to be in different sports and Girl Scouts and that kind of thing, I just wanted to be there for them, but it was such a fight. It was so hard.
What about other relationships? How were they affected by your depression?
I would say, as far as friends go, I didn't call them as often. I always said, oh, no, I don't really feel like it. And they knew I had depression. I didn't keep it a secret. Just told them I was feeling rather down and I just couldn't do it. And then with my husband, boy, he's just been wonderful through all this, very patient and loving. And I felt so guilty in the way that I was running my day each day and really trying to be there for him. And again, like I tell you, it's so tiresome. It's really a chore where it should have been easy.
So it wasn't necessarily a positive thing on your marriage.
Oh, no, not at all. I was just lucky I had him because I've had a friend whose husband left her. He couldn't deal with the depression.
Okay. So that's often the case with depression, is it's
mm-hmm.
not a positive thing on a relationship.
Yep, and I can see
in the long
that.
Term.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so talk about in the past some treatments that you've tried and what that was like for you.
Okay, well, of course, I started seeing a psychiatrist and then got on medication, the first one being Prozac. And that was in California because I lived in California before coming here, and I've been here for 21 years. And so just kind of seeing psychiatrist back and forth and trying new medications. And then about a year or so ago, I tried ECT. And that was rather intrusive, I guess I want to say. You would go in and they would sedate you, put you under completely, and they would cause you to have convulsions. Just little ones, you know, but it had to meet a certain criteria, which I always didn't meet it, so it wasn't a successful session. So that was done for, about almost 2 months, I believe. And it just made me so tired. So when I came out of it, I did feel a little bit of relief as far as depression went. However, I felt very alone and on the outside looking in and just really tired. And so I didn't want to experience that anymore. So as far as going in for little booster shots of it, I decided not to go that route anymore with ECT.
Okay. If you're tuning in for the first time today, this is Dr. David Kent. I have a weekly radio show. I'm a psychiatrist in the Treasure Valley area. I practice in Boise We've got a guest on today, Debbie. She's talking about her experience with depression and treatment, and we're going to keep talking with her a little bit. So it sounds like, you know, ECT or electroconvulsive therapy is considered the big gun for treating depression. It's a really big gun, and people don't go to that until they've failed just about everything else. So how many medicines do you think you may have tried in the past?
Oh, my gosh. I would say it easily 15, between 15 and 20.
Wow. That's about all the meds are on the market, pretty much.
Yes.
For the most part.
I would say yes.
And those didn't exactly work for you.
No, they worked for a certain length of time, and then I built up an intolerance, and then I went on to the next one. And then I went back to therapy so I could be talking with somebody. And just a long, long road of not being happy.
That must have been discouraging.
Very discouraging. And I really wanted to be happy.
When people find that things aren't working for them, they tend to develop a sense of hopelessness.
Mm.
Was that the case for you?
Oh, that's definitely so. Hopelessness and just, like I said, feeling alone, feeling not worthy. It's just all negative all down the line. There wasn't any positive there whatsoever. So hopelessness, you know, you just feel like you're a burden on your family, and why do I even need to be here? So you really hit it very low.
When you hit those lows, did you even contemplate taking your own life?
I did. I know I wouldn't act on it, but I did contemplate it, yes.
Okay, that's pretty normal and consistent with what I see as a psychiatrist. People, when they get severe depression, especially when it's not responding to treatment, there seems to be no way out of this except mm-hmm. to take your own life.
And yes.
It's no fun living that way and feeling miserable
mm-hmm.
and really not enjoying life at all.
That is so true. And also you just wish you just would be dead. Everybody would be better off without you.
Okay. So, moving forward a little bit, how did you find out about my treatment and Mike?
I see a great psychiatrist named Dr. Gilbreth. And I've been going for years with him, and he's been so great in trying different things and then also suggesting the ECT and suggesting going and talking to a therapist. And then finally, he said, now this is going to be great for you. And so far, so good.
So you referred you to me to see if you're a candidate for deep TMS.
Yes, yes. And I did have to go, of course, as you know, and an interview to see if I was indeed a candidate for it. And yes, I was.
Okay. I was happy to hear that. Yes. So for those listening in, deep TMS stands, or the TMS part stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's an FDA-approved device now on the market. There's many devices on the market, but I use a BrainsWay deep TMS, which is I call a second-generation device, which I'm very pleased with, and it stimulates the nerve cells in the brain, particularly the areas of the brain that are associated with depression. And by activating those cells, we hope that the depression can be turned around. So how many sessions have you had so far with the deep TMS?
I have had 15.
15.
And after we finish here today, I go in for the 16th one.
16th one.
Mm-hmm.
For those listening in, a typical course is around 30 to 36 treatments. People come in 5 days a week for 20 minutes to get a treatment, not on the weekends, just during the week, and they get treatment. And studies have shown that this has durability, meaning that if it works, it can work for a long period of time, and we can always revisit it if we need to, and it will work again. So in your case, I know you, so
yes.
I've seen the transformation. I've yes. seen your face go from being sad and restricted and feeling hopeless and really kind of desperate to what it is now.
Yes, desperate is right. Yes, at the first session even, if you can believe it or not, I felt a sense of being light. The heaviness was pretty much gone. So it was like, oh, wow, I'm looking at the world through different eyes. So I was really pleased with it. And so I was gung-ho and am gung-ho on following up.
I'm always happy when I see someone responds, especially early on. So I want them to get results. I want this to work. And I never promise anybody that it's going to work, but I really am rooting for them to make it work, and I do everything in my power to make sure it's done correctly. And you're another example of someone who's doing really well with it after 37 years of depression and using the big gun, which is ECT, and 15 to 20 medications, years of psychotherapy, and pow, in one treatment, you've seen a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. That is for sure. And I keep... But he has a wonderful staff, so it's been something I look forward to, even going in and getting the treatments. And each time it seems to just improve a little bit more, and it stays longer.
That's what we're looking for. That's why we do multiple treatments, even if someone responds completely early on. We do all the treatments because it seems to sort of solidify it and make it last longer, which is our goal. We want to... And we often can get people free of their medications with TMS, which is pretty exciting.
That's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah.
Right now I'm on 5 antidepressants.
Yeah, we'll talk with Dr. Gilbert about seeing if we can start to simplify that.
Ooh, that'd be cool.
Should be able to do that without too much difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
So, your husband, how does he feel about how you're doing?
Oh, he definitely sees a difference. And it's been great because we bought a new house, so now I really feel like working on it and getting together and talking about plans and all that. Whereas before, I just kind of just sat out, watched TV, and didn't do much of anything. So he's definitely has seen an improvement, and he's told me so.
So you're kind of a spectator a little bit before.
Yes.
Now you're a participant.
Yes.
You're actually
exactly
engaged
right.
in things and doing things
mm-hmm.
and making things happen.
Yes, for sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm so glad for that.
Anything else you want to say about the treatment or about your recovery or how you're doing or anything that you want to say out there that people should hear?
Well, I just want to say, if you're a candidate, please give it a try. It really made a big difference. And like I said, being depressed for 37 years and then now I'm on the road to recovery, I feel. I just really think it is a definite positive experience.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on my show today. It's been great to have you.
Thank you, Dr. Kent.
You've done an awesome job.
Thank you.
Very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. You make me that way.
Congratulations. So tune in next week. I come in on every Sunday at 9 in the morning. I'm trying to bring in different guests and different people on the show to keep it interesting. Make it relevant to people who live in the Treasure Valley to see what the latest is in terms of treatment for mental illness and mental disorders. So thank you for tuning in, and I'll sign off for this week.